listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay, all things considered. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Paul Bloom, famous psychologist, writer, author of many books. Some of them not, frankly, not all that long, but still technically books, whatever, right? And so, Paul, you know, over the last few weeks since we last spoke, the question I've gotten probably most often from viewers and listeners is it now safe to say that Paul Bloom has weathered the Potato Gate scandal? And some quick background. So you have this newsletter.
This reminds me that I didn't want to discuss the small potatoes scandal.
You have this.
There's something I want to tell you before, and this is it. But go on.
You
know,
before we taped, you wanted to say
before
please
we taped,
nothing.
I want to say let's not talk about this. But go.
Even though it involves plugging your newsletter, Small Potatoes on Substack.
We can say small potatoes a lot. I guess that's a good thing.
Okay, small potatoes. Can I now proceed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, go ahead.
So anyway, it emerged. You've got this newsletter, Small Potatoes. It emerged through the hard work of a number of investigative journalists, myself included, I must say, that you actually don't know much about potatoes at all, and all of your potato-related credentials are fake. Not to put too fine a point on it, but fake.
I enjoy myself some good French fries, but that's about as close as you get.
Who among us is not? That doesn't do it. So are things, or is like your working definition of weathering it, like when I shut up about it, is that what we're waiting for?
Yes. What? So you have pestered me about the fact that there's someone else who has a Substack, Small Potatoes, who is
and had one before you. Go ahead.
And had one. So A, she had one before me. B, she's a rabbi, while I have no religious credentials at all. And C, she actually grows potatoes.
Bingo. That's the key. That's the whole scandal. She has credentials you don't, and you're an interloper.
I am an interloper. She got there first. And despite what we said last time we spoke, I have not actually initiated legal action against her. I didn't have some sort of Elon Musk move where I sicked my lawyers on her.
Excellent segue.
There we go. Elon Musk.
Because I never tire of talking about Elon.
I will also just say, by the way, we're going to get small potatoes. My wife informed me. She was looking
around. It's funny. You don't want to talk about it, but once we get on it, you won't shut up.
I know.
Okay, go ahead.
I see. I moved to a paid tier, so I got to kind of push it a little bit.
Oh, that's right.
But do you know the opposite of small potatoes?
Big tomatoes? I don't know. What is it?
The term came up hundreds of years ago. Some pumpkins. So back in the time of, I don't know, Benjamin Franklin or something, people would say, you know, you're small potatoes, but he's small, some pumpkins. And that means small potatoes, something small and irrelevant and not that matter. Some pumpkins
is important
and majestic.
Yeah. Some pumpkins.
Exactly.
Like Elon Musk. Elon Musk is some pumpkins.
He really truly is. He's some pumpkins.
Yeah. He's some pumpkins.
Yeah, so he's in the news lately. I was listening to, we're gonna talk about I guess his interview with Don Lemon.
And not totally unrelated, the Sam Altman interview with Lex Fridman. Because I wanna ask. Well, I go ahead. I'll tell you what I want to ask.
So I actually, surprisingly, I know about, I listened to a competing podcast, Pivot with Kara Swisher and Scott Galloway. They had Lemon on talking about his experience. I am unusually informed about this.
I'm less informed about the Elon interview. I've seen segments of it. Then the Sam Altman interview. I'm interested. I want to do a little compare and contrast as long as I've got an eminent psychologist on the line between Sam Altman and Elon Musk in terms of how close the two, each of them is to having full-blown messiah complex. But to review, so Elon, Don Lemon has a show on Twitter, which I guess was considered a big get for Twitter, although I think Don Lemon had already been fired from CNN, right? But so he wanted to interview Elon Musk, and Elon said sure. And then Elon didn't like the interview, And he said, screw you, Don Lemon. And email or told Don Lemon's agent, the deal is over or something.
Yes. I mean, Lemon didn't read the entire email, or maybe it might have been a text, but he said it was quite obscene. And it ended with the word contract canceled.
Okay.
So he was, they had not signed. They had not totally agreed to this, although this is going to be in the hands of lawyers because Lemon was quite insistent that some money is coming to him. But Elon Musk was so offended by the interview, and he was definitely offended while it was happening, that, you know, some free speech champion, he said, no, you're done.
Well, that's not entirely incompatible with the concept of free speech. It gets at the question of like what Twitter is. You know, if it's just like a publisher, then sure, you don't have to run any. If you own a magazine, there's lots of articles you choose not to run and lots of people you choose not to feature. On the other hand,
it is very much within Elon Musk's right to hire and not hire who he wants.
It is, although these platforms get a kind of legal protection that magazines don't get, which is that they're not, because of Section 230 or whatever in the American law, they're not responsible for what's said on the platform, basically, legally responsible. I saw the part about ketamine. And I guess, was that the thing Elon was most offended by when Lemon kind of was pressing him on his ketamine use? Elon says, yes, I have a prescription. I take it to deal with depression or sadness. And was the whole thing kind of contentious?
It was the whole thing. I think it was just Lemon was asking him hard questions and Musk took it very, very poorly. And but it might have been, I don't know what the key, it might have been the ketamine thing upset Musk the most. Even though Lemon said that Musk actually did not come off bad in that segment. He just said, well, you know, this is a legitimate alternative to SSRIs and people need help and so on. And I didn't hear the actual thing, but it didn't seem that bad. I wonder whether for sort of SEC reasons, legal reasons, that Musk's use of a fairly powerful drug is something he does not want to broadcast or shouldn't want to broadcast.
Well, it had been broadcast. There was a Wall Street Journal article about his drug use. It was all over the place. And to get an opportunity to say it's a prescription.
Yeah, that's right.
And kind of dodge the question of whether he ever uses it recreationally, I would think, you know, that's not altogether a bad thing. Because probably most people who have seen the word ketamine associated with Musk think it's totally a recreational thing.
Yes. Is that what killed Matthew Perry?
You know, I don't really know. I think there may, I don't know. Usually
I don't know.
More than one thing in the bloodstream of these people, but I don't know. I don't even know if you can OD. I guess you can OD on anything. I haven't heard of a lot of ketamine, overdoses. But it's funny, you know, there are a number of people in Silicon Valley I've heard, after interactions with journalists, speak about journalism in a way that indicates that they just don't understand journalism, the incentive structure journalists have, and so on. And if you did, you would know that when Don Lemon interviews Elon Musk, the guy who owns the platform he's on, he has to establish his journalistic bona fides by asking tough questions. Yeah. Or people are gonna, you know, so that was totally expected. But of course, it's funny, you know, I'm saying Musk could have exercised some cognitive empathy, as we say in the cognitive empathy advocacy business, which just means perspective taking. But of course, you know, Musk has said that he's on the spectrum and was in a kind of a serious way as a kid. And one of the known features of being on the spectrum is you may have so-called theory of mind deficit, which is to say you're not good at putting yourself in the shoes of other people and seeing their perspective, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it might just be simpler where maybe he knew intellectually that this was going to be a tough interview and expected it. But when the questions came flying, he couldn't help but get extremely upset. And in the midst of him being extremely upset, he said, "You know, screw you. I'm not going to pay you."
Which leads me to my biggest Elon-related grievance, which is not unrelated. His behavior in the Substack case. You know, he is still not. You know, they did so Twitter. he viewed all other apparently media phenomena as these competitors or something. And so for a while, yeah. The deal was that if you put the link to, say, a Washington Post piece in, it would no longer automatically feature a clickable graphic with the headline. Then he allowed them to at least say, it would say Washington Post with a clickable graphic, but not the headline. That was the worst of all worlds, because then you had to click to find out what it was about. You had to leave Twitter to find it. So now they do put the headlines in the graphic, but they still don't do that, as I understand it, for Substack URLs. Why is that? Because Musk threw a hissy fit back when Substack was starting what seemed to be a rival to Twitter, Notes. Well, look, Notes, you know, it has its virtues. Go check it out. But it is obviously not going to be a Twitter rival. So calm down. And yet he continues to exercise his vendetta against Substack in a way that I think is contrary to his interests. Because, look, most of us Substack newsletter operators are not, as we say, some pumpkins. Okay? Many of us are medium-sized to small potatoes. But there's a bunch of us, and some of them are big, some pumpkins. Yeah. And it's like all of us collectively are not nothing. And I spend less time on Twitter because it is a less useful promotional platform for me. And I just think it would be in his interest to integrate it into the Substack conversation. But he's just a child. He is like Trump in the sense of having an emotional age of 13.
Do you think he's going to end up endorsing Trump, like fully endorsing him, maybe putting the resources of the platform behind him?
I would think he's genuinely ambivalent about Trump himself. I mean, you know, Musk is a smart guy, and I'm sure there's a lot of things Trump says that he doesn't like, including the war on China, by the way, the very belligerent attitude toward China. I mean, leave aside whether it's because Musk has commercial interests in China. I personally am very pro-engagement and anti-Cold War on China, so I don't, whatever leads him to take that position is kind of fine with me, but there's a lot of things he wouldn't like about Trump. I don't know. Look, he's an amazing guy. Everyone says this after they get through trashing him. He's an amazing guy. I mean, this came up on the Lex Fridman, Sam Altman thing, and they both go, he's an amazing guy, he's an amazing guy. You know, but even Lex Fridman, of course, Sam Altman is in this big contention with him. You know, Musk sued OpenAI because he had been one of the big donor back when it was truly a nonprofit, and he felt it had betrayed its mission. But even Lex Fridman, who speaks ill of very few people and speaks very little ill of them.
A lot of love in him, Lex Fridman.
There's a lot of love in Lex, yeah. He said, yeah, that part of Elon, I wish he'd let that go, kind of. That's as far as Lex is going to go ever. And of course, you know, he's had Elon on the podcast. He'd like to have him again. But anyway, so everyone has something negative to say about Elon. But then both of Sam and Lex turn around. I don't know why I'm calling them Sam and Lex. They don't call me Bob or know who I am. But so they both said, you know, but he's done amazing things. And he has. He's in a completely, I mean, his track record is amazing. And I would say all the more amazing, given his weird emotional and sometimes seemingly cognitive quirks, right? It's like, how did he do all this?
Yeah, I think Elon Musk is a good refutation of a simplistic notion of people, which is, oh, they're smart, they're dumb, they're good, they're bad. Right. Which is, I've heard, you know, again, this podcast, heard Kara Swisher say, oh, Elon, what a dope, what a moron. And she's focusing on aspects of Musk, which are dopey and moronic, destructive, insulting his advertisers, saying, you know, fuck you, literally, fuck you to his advertisers. Not good business. But at the same time, it's undeniable that this guy is in other venues brilliant. You know, you read Isaacson biography and there's story after story. And Isaacson is by no means a fanboy of Musk, but story after story of him walking into a room full of engineers who are expert in something and basically leaving them dazzled and impressed by what he's by his capacity for thought and for focus. You know, Musk is complicated. I think personally he's very complicated. I think I think these last few years have not been good for him. He's become obsessed with wokeness and anti-wokeness and that, which is a lot of people have fallen into that. Well, this is why I think he might endorse Trump, just for that.
Yeah, and also he likes to mess with people's heads on a wholesale basis. And what would annoy more people in America right now than
exactly.
For him to? It's funny. So Kara Swisher ties into, I mean, first of all, you know, she's an example. I mean, he will turn on a dime and say, you are dead to me.
Yeah.
To an old friend, to anybody. I mean, the landscape, his trail is littered with former friends and allies. Sam Altman is one. Kara Swisher is another.
Yeah.
She used to write favorably about him. And then he basically said, you're dead to me after she wrote.
There's a guy on Twitter, I'm blanking on his name, who worked closely with Musk on all sorts of things, and Musk turned on him and basically told the world that he's a pedophile, which is Musk's insult of choice.
Well, you know, this is somebody other than the guy in Thailand, the cave rescue guy.
Different from the boat rescue guy. This is a close associate of Musk who is a gay man and he's written things before about access to sexual content to young people, but you know, and Musk entirely distorted this. They had a falling out, and you know, the guy had to move the guy, and it's just horrible.
No, he's a horrible person.
He's a horrible person.
In important respects.
Yes.
The Swisher thing, though, this is another ingenious segue on your part, bringing her up. Because that's
remember,
the first
we got to get back to Altman, too.
Well, this is taking us back. That's what a genius you are. This is the path back to Altman.
It's all you, Bob. You're just...
No, Paul, you're too kind. I'm small potatoes. You are some pumpkin, though. So I first started thinking, man, Elon Musk has a serious messiah complex. When I was listening to Kara Swisher recount, I hope I got this right, a time when... He basically said to her something like, and meant it, I hope this, you know, something like, you know, if Tesla fails, and I guess it was one of the many moments of peril for Tesla in the past, if, you know, basically, if Tesla fails, the planet is doomed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's funny because, you know, I had Reid Hoffman on the podcast, who was also part of the initial several donors to OpenAI. He's founder
of LinkedIn. And some pumpkins, really.
And he is some pumpkins. And he's also the founder of Inflection, which has this interesting AI thing, PI.AI. And he said, I brought up Sam Altman in the context of Messiah Complex. I wrote a piece for my newsletter, Non-Zero, called Sam Altman Aspiring Messiah. And Reid said, well, the litmus test is like, it's one thing to devote your life to saving the planet, but a messiah complex is when you think you're the only one who can do it. And that's like when Elon says, if Tesla fails, it's like nobody else can build electric cars, right? It's like, what are you talking about? I mean, I suppose he could say, if Tesla fails, that'll be so bad for the credibility of electric cars. But in the end, I mean, look, he had got electric cars had gotten to a point and would have gotten to this point anyway, I think, where the market would judge, right?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, people either want them or don't. And so for him to say that, I thought that is, first of all, I pause for your reaction as a psychologist, Paul. Am I right in thinking, a little weird.
Yeah. Maybe not weird once you get in the world of billionaires and people who are surrounded by those who tell them how brilliant they are and yes men and sycophants and so on. Yeah. Even then, a little bit weird.
I mean, most of these billionaires do not think that if their own business model fails, the planet will perish, right?
Yeah. I feel this way about my Substack, though. I feel
a world with no small potatoes is a world not worth living in, or a world that actually does not exist.
No, the world would seem the same to many people, but it would really not be worth
it. It would not be the same world.
I mean, let me say something. Let me say something nice about Elon Musk, which is related to the Messiah complex, which is I think he generally wants us to become, I forget the phrase, like an interplanetary species.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't want to make money. I mean, he does want to make money as a tool to doing that. But he's fairly, seems to be fairly indifferent to certain things, financial things. And it is in the service of this grand goal, which can itself be seen kind of as messianic.
Yeah, now maybe, but although in a way, maybe this undercuts my Messiah complex thesis, because if his argument was, if Tesla fails, I won't be able to fund this mission to Mars thing, and that's something nobody else is going to do because it doesn't make economic sense right now, that's a less self-involved, slightly less self-involved rationale in
that's
a
right.
way.
That's right. That's right. Okay. It's not incompatible to think you're Messiah and work on a quest which is really for the good of all.
Right.
And would make the world a better place. He said at some point that he wants, his goal is to die in space or die on Mars. And I think Kara Swisher said that's my goal too.
A lot of people would be okay with that. Okay, so back to Altman. Now the question arises with Altman. Now, when I wrote my piece on a couple of months ago or something on Altman, it was addressing this like paradox that on the one hand, he seems to be very concerned about AI risk. And only last week I talked to the second person I've talked to who knows him and says it's true. He's really genuinely concerned. But the other half of the paradox is he's racing full speed ahead with OpenAI, and if anything, accelerating the evolution of AI, which I would think would give us less time to think about it and figure stuff out. So how do you resolve the paradox? And I found this 2015 blog post of his. This is months before OpenAI was founded. And he wrote, in an ideal world, regulation would slow down the bad guys and speed up the good guys. It seems like what happens with the first SMI, which is super machine intelligence, it seems like what happens with the first SMI to be developed will be very important. I take that to mean it's important that a good guy get to the super intelligence threshold first. And clearly, Sam Altman thinks of himself as a good guy, don't we all? There's nothing crazy about that. But I actually think here, if there's a kind of mistake, it's in the way he's thinking about the future of AI, and as if, well, you know, there's going to be one super intelligence and whoever builds it will then control it for the good of all mankind. I don't know what he's thinking, but the idea, anyway, yeah, it has to do with the way they think about AI alignment as this silver bullet that's going to solve everything and so on. I have a lot of critiques of that worldview, which I won't get into now. I just want to add the most recent data point. You tell me, this is not a super, super odd thing to say, and in some ways not odd at all, what he said on the Lex Fridman podcast. But the exchange was, Lex was talking about, you know, how nuclear power, you know, you'd had these accidents like Chernobyl, and that soured everyone's taste for everyone. And so it wound up, you know, through what people like Altman think is an overreaction. It wound up killing basically nuclear power, at least slowing it down very considerably. And Altman says, I worry that the same thing will happen with AI. In other words, something will go, you know, it'll be responsible for some very horrible outcome and people say, crush it, you know? And I would say one difference between this and nuclear energy is it's, I think, kind of uncrushable. But here's the quote from Altman. And the exchange has just been what I described. Nuclear power, Altman says, yeah, I worry the same thing about AI. And then he says, quote, I think some things are going to go theatrically wrong with AI. I don't know what the percent chance is that I eventually get shot, but it's not zero. And Lex says, oh, like we want to stop this? In other words, they kill you to stop AI? And Sam says, maybe. I thought that was a little odd on a couple of grounds. Does it strike you as odd to kind of bring that? It was a little bit out of nowhere. Yeah. And not quite. There was a segue, but...
Yeah, so two things. I totally agree with your critique of his earlier blog posters. There's all these worries about super intelligent AI. And, you know, we could debate over how valid they are. But the worries don't have to do with who makes them. It could be the Chinese. It could be Elon Musk. It could be Sam Altman, whatever. But the idea is that once you have a machine of sufficient powers and capacities, you can no longer control it. It may not be aligned with our interests. It might end up doing some sort of loop that makes it smarter and smarter and smarter, more powerful. And, you know, you could debate that, but none of this has to do whether it's a nice person or a bad person who creates it. It really is sort of a genie out of the bottle situation. Who cares who released it? So the logic doesn't work.
I would, the form of pushback you could get, I more or less agree, but the form of pushback would be some of these people take seriously an idea that I don't quite totally dismiss, but that, you know, the kind of sci-fi doomers in the AI community mm-hmm. take seriously the possibility that you get to the point where the autonomous AIs are competing with each other for world dominance. Okay. Yeah. And if you have created the most powerful AI and aligned it, as they say, with human values and goals, so it's good, it'll take care of us, it squashes the other ones or triumphs over them and everything is okay. That's the only scenario I can think of where that's the farthest from a completely implausible scenario where what he's saying makes sense, I guess.
So we're all creating our superpower superhero, and Sam Altman will create Superman, who is a good person. And
a good person, and then Superman will vanquish Lex Luthor, and yes.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's one way of reading it. I don't know. I understand. It's not irrational for all. It's not unusual for somebody to take particularly focused on the worry that they themselves will be killed. And yeah. It may be a strange thing to say, but he's not wrong.
No, look, he's not. He's not entirely wrong.
We don't yet. You know, I haven't followed Yudkowsky. He's the AI guy. I haven't followed everything he said, but at times he has alluded to said. The issue here is sufficiently serious that I don't want to put words in his mouth, but one could listen to him and come to the conclusion that assassinating people involved in AI is actually a legitimate and moral response. These people are going to bring out the end of the world.
If you took him seriously and were a utilitarian,
yeah,
and everyone in his camp is utilitarian, so that's a kind of good point. I mean, I'm not holding him responsible for anything, but
yeah,
I mean, people have said, so what he's saying is we should bomb the centers of compute, you know, all the That's big, right. powerful clouds where they can train these things. These days, any super famous person has some risk of, what's his name? The guy who somehow translated Taxi Driver into shooting, it was either John Lennon or Reagan.
That was John Lennon. Yeah. I'm blanking on the guy's name.
Hinckley or something.
Was it John Hinckley?
Either Reagan or anyway, Lennon was John Hinckley. But,
we're getting our assassins mixed up.
Yeah.
But there's a special thing with Altman, which is there's a movie which hasn't happened yet. And if this was a good science fiction novel, this would be a main thing, which is a group of violent AI Luddites who are a terrorist group. Who seek out to kill prominent computer scientists and bomb AI centers. This hasn't happened. Maybe because the people who are AI doomers are sort of basically fairly nerdy sorts who will write articles and blogs and be on podcasts, but won't pick up guns. Yeah. But it hasn't happened. But it could.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I was kind of surprised is like, if I were him, I wouldn't give anybody ideas. Yeah. I mean, look, if there are some half-crazed people out there already thinking about this, they're probably listening to this podcast. It's a very prominent podcast. And it's like, all they're waiting for is a sign from God. I mean, right? I mean, that's the way these people are. It's like, if the movie Taxi Driver can be a sign that you should kill John Lennon, I mean, I don't know. I personally would like... look, he doesn't need to take advice from me. I'm sure he has a good security detail.
Well, maybe Taxi Driver's to John Lennon what Terminator 2 is to Sam Altman. you know, you
funny,
watch.
Funny, this is another brilliant segue because we're going to talk about movies. And I would just quickly say, I finally watched Terminator 1. I hadn't seen any of the Terminator movies. I thought it just totally sucked. I got to say.
No.
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I mean, it was just so low. It was just so low on intellectual and philosophical content compared to like the number of chase scenes. I hate chase scenes. You know, people say cut to the chase. I say cut to the end of the chase.
I don't mind chase scenes, but it is true that when everybody picks up the guns and they have a long gunfight, I'd rather they just stipulate it. Say there's a long gunfight and this is what happens at the
end. You almost always know what's going to happen at the end based on where you are in the plot. Who can die? Who can't die? Who's going to get caught? Who's not? You know, it's.
But have you seen Terminator 2?
No.
Oh, you should. Yeah, as an AI person.
People say it's better than one or more relevant to my interest.
It is much better. It is very clever. The chase scenes are good. No, Terminator 2 is an excellent movie. I don't remember Terminator 1 enough to defend it, but Terminator 2 is wonderful.
Yeah. So we're going to talk
about movies.
We're going to talk about movies. We're going to talk about Oscars. We're also eventually going to talk about the TikTok question. And I think we're not going to have time to exhaust the subject of movies before we reach the point where the dreaded paywall shows up, but we're not there yet. We're going to talk about some movies.
But we're not going to exhaust the topic of movies because you haven't seen them.
No, I haven't seen them. But speaking of this, Paul, so we're going to talk about Oscar movies, but let me just say something about movies, okay? You had one job, Paul. What was that job? What was that movie-related job? What did I ask you to do?
The job was to watch the movie, Harvey.
Did you watch it?
I have not watched it
You have yet. Not watched it. Okay, so listen. It is well known that you're doing whatever you can to become like a podcast star. All of the friends I have in common with you say, Paul will not stop talking about how he wants to climb to the top of the greasy podcast pole, right? And Paul, I have some advice, okay? Listen to the masters. I'm not saying I am a master. But I'm not saying I'm not. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So just when I say, could you please watch Harvey? Could you please watch Harvey?
I will watch Harvey. You asked me to watch something else, which I did, and I enjoyed it.
Show Jury Duty.
I watched the first episode.
You watched the first episode.
I watched the whole thing.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I watched it while in a hotel room at a conference. It goes by quickly.
It does.
But
it's good. Well, we can talk about that in overtime too. I'm writing it down because you had only watched episode one when we.
Yes. I will watch Harvey. I imagine it's on the theme of mental illness, and you know we talked about.
Wait, what is on the theme of mental illness?
Harvey?
Kind of. Yeah. No, it is. That definitely enters it for sure. And drinking and being an alcoholic, but it's all very lighthearted. Yeah.
And there's a giant rabbit.
And there seems to be a rabbit. You never actually see the rabbit, but there seems to be one.
We had a discussion last week about Bushnell, the man who set himself on fire for a cause.
To protest the Israeli conduct, the Gaza war. And you pre-registered the prediction that he would turn out to be mentally ill.
I had concluded that he would, yes.
Have you amassed evidence to that effect?
No, I haven't. And I kind of thought back on our discussion. I want to give it another go. I want to talk more generally about what mental illness is, because I think there's some really deep, deep questions there. So getting Harvey, adding that to the mix.
Okay.
Will be good.
So that will be the occasion for revisiting. So
I've been wondering why my career has sort of seemed to stall at this point, and maybe I'm just not putting in the work.
Because you're not following the guidance of the masters.
I'm not following the guidance of the masters. I'm one movie short of you know, ascending up this greasy hole.
So I think I have watched maybe zero of, like, if you look at all the nominations for the Oscars, I've watched maybe zero of those movies. Well, but
you have not seen Oppenheimer?
I have not seen Oppenheimer.
Barbie?
I have seen Barbie. Now, Oppenheimer, okay. I don't like historical movies because even the most faithful to history of them make shit up. Yes. It reminds me in a certain sense of the Potato Gate scandal, but I digress. They make shit up. And I just don't know what to trust. Like, Like, if I'm going to spend time on some historical thing, I just want it to be a documentary where I can say, well, they may have chosen the facts selectively or whatever, but if it's a reputable documentary, the facts themselves are probably true and I'm learning something. But you can't do that with movies. Anyway, but I did watch part of the Oscars. I have a little something to say about some of the...
We tried to watch the Oscars and we realized that we actually can't get television, only streaming services. So we had to hurriedly get a VPN to connect to the States and it was complicated. Whoa. So we missed the beginning, but I thought the Oscars were wonderful. They were actually funny. I thought the speeches were good. I liked the Ryan Gosling musical number.
I kind of just dipped into it occasionally, like would walk into the living room. But I will be able to announce the winner for most annoyingly theatrical acceptance speech, even though I only saw a couple of them. I'm still willing to go out on a limb with this. I doubt anything rivaled this. Can you predict my winner for that?
Well, I don't know. I'm curious whether it's going to be the Zone of Interest.
I didn't see that.
It was a controversial speech because...
About Palestine?
This was the Holocaust one, and this speech made reference to, there's some line about people hiding behind, something about, I'm not going to be able to get the line exactly right, but something about people's Jewishness while complicit in terrible crimes.
Yeah, I didn't see that. I read about it.
What was the most annoying speech?
That's a different category of most political or something. Yeah. I mean, maybe it was theatrical too, but, what do you, before we disappear into overtime.
Wait. But you're going to tell me what the most annoying or theatrical speech was.
I'm going with Emma Stone.
Oh, I find her.
Did you fall for that? Oh, Paul, I have got a bridge I want to sell you. You thought that was really spontaneous? Oh, the back of my dress. Who knew? Come on, Paul, wake up.
I find her such an endearing character as a person.
That was such... Oh, please.
She had rehearsed
that. She spent hours in rehearsal for that whole supposed... And every part of it was supposed to be spontaneous. I'm telling you, it was all in her head before they announced anything.
What's it like to be so cynical and go through life?
You know, it's more fun than you might think. There are so many targets of opportunity.
So the host of the Oscars, I got to mix up Jimmy Kimmel.
It was him, yes.
Jimmy Kimmel made a joke about Poor Things, and he said something like, "There was a trailer for Poor Things shown because they did a little clip of it," and he said, "You know, he made a joke, and he said these are the only parts we're allowed to show on TV," implying that because the movie has a lot of sex in it and a lot of explicit sex in it.
Ah.
And then the camera turns, and I've seen a clip of it. Emma Stone turns to her husband and says very clearly, "What a prick."
And, really?
I think that's honesty.
That was rehearsed.
Oh my God. God. Anyway, you haven't seen Poor Things either.
No, but I've heard good things about it. My question is, what is its genre? So it's not, I know very little about it, but it's not like sci-fi because it's in, for one thing, it's in the takes place in the 19th century or something, or?
It takes place in somewhat of an alternative world.
Right. Where weird shit happens.
It's hard, where weird shit happens. It is genre defying. I think it was, I know people felt very strongly about the film, sometimes very negatively. But it's whatever it is, it was very imaginative.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved Oppenheimer. I don't regret it's becoming best picture, but you wouldn't describe it as imaginative in the same sense.
No. Although he has done some imaginative movies. Memento, Christopher Nolan has. Memento was a great movie. Inception was a little harder to, well, they were both hard to follow, but.
And then Tenet was incomprehensible.
I didn't see that.
The time travel stuff. But, I thought.
Oh, wait. Which one?
Tenet.
Now he didn't do Interstellar, did he?
He did Interstellar, which is about the power of love.
Which one? Tenet or?
Interstellar.
I thought was good. It did have one, I thought. paradox that even the kind of paradox you're not supposed to have even in a time travel movie. But anyway,
there's also, I've been told, an anti-environmentalist joke in there where one of the characters is called, I think this is correct, Michael Mann, who is actually in real life the name of an environmentalist advocate, and Michael Mann turns out to be the character turns out to be lying and deceiving people into self interest.
Huh. But people do that.
People do, yes, yes.
Huh. See, I'm so far from cynicism that I had not dreamed.
I'm a fan of Christopher Nolan, but my favorite movies of him are In the Distant Past, there, Memento, and even better, The Prestige, which is a wonderful movie. You should see it. Drop everything and see it.
Maybe I'll see it and we'll discuss it. But, you know, we're approaching the part where the paywall goes up. By the way, let's get back to your newsletter, Small Potatoes, because if it is not already the case, it will someday be the case. You tell me which is which. That you can get these podcasts, including if you become a paid subscriber. Look, there's two ways to hear the overtime thing of this conversation. You can become a paid subscriber to the Non-Zero newsletter, which I recommend, or a paid subscriber to Small Potatoes, which I don't recommend, but whatever. People make bad decisions in life. Is it not? It's going to be the case that all of our collected archives, works, as we call them, including all the overtime segments for last several conversations, whenever we started doing this, will be on Small Potatoes. That's should right. Should people make the wrong
it's
call?
It's one of the perks for paid customers. I didn't want to write articles specifically for paid customers, because me writing is really hard. And if I'm going to write something, and we talked about it before, just straight off, I want to write. But I wanted to, you know, make something. So one thing is these episodes will be available. There's other perks people could look up. But yeah, so one would hope that somebody would want to do both, do the paid version of my Substack, but also sign on for the Non-Zero.
Yeah. So people can either become paid subscribers to Small Potatoes and get this, or become paid subscribers to Non-Zero, get this, and a ton of other shit, including free ketamine. And it's really up to them. It's really
Have you tried ketamine?
I have not.
I have not either.
But I mean, my closing thought about that, and then the paywall will materialize, is Elon compared it to SSRIs, and yet it is also a party drug. And if it's a party drug, there's a difference between it and SSRIs, right? I mean, there are therapeutically prescribed drugs that are prone to abuse and those that are not. And I kind of think SSRIs are not. That doesn't mean you can't, in some sense, become dependent on them.
Yes.
It's just not a party drug, right?
I'm not even sure you could become dependent on SSRIs. I mean,
well, I think withdrawal can be painful. For sure.
I mean, the idea of SSRIs is you take them, and then maybe 3 weeks later, your mood improves slightly. And you also have, you know, the serious side effects. Weight gain, sexual dysfunction, sleep problems. It's not, you
well,
don't
wait,
think
the
of it
sexual
as a party
dysfunction.
Drug.
I'm going to talk about this in overtime. We got to go in overtime. The sexual, well, this will be the first topic. I'm going to question the premise that the effect that SSRIs have on sexual appetite qualifies for the term, quote, sexual dysfunction, Paul. And that's the edge of the seat that we're leaving people on.
Boy, okay.
Okay, but we're also going to talk about Oscars and whatever else we said.
TikTok.
Okay. So thanks, everybody. If you want to listen to the rest, go to one of those two Substack newsletters and whatever. It's all the same to me. Become a paid subscriber to one or to both. Someday we may offer a joint subscription discount. Who knows? But now just subscribe to both and you're supporting good causes.
Yeah.
And thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time.